Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and there's all sorts of crap that's just happening around us. And folks, I think there are plenty of people that are just telling you how bad or how great things are. We have to demand full compliance with the Constitution. We're going through the ratification. We're going through the resolution. Starts with an R. Yeah, there's a path, right? Or at least started off right. The resolutions clearly lay out that we have to interpose. And I think it's great that the resistance, or I should say the corrupt part of our government, has literally told us, you know, there is no hope. You can't do those things. We won't allow it. Wait. Once we take back, once we actually go into the counties and take back the counties and take the states, once we have enough states to start putting pressure, anybody and everybody, whether they're sitting on the Supreme Court, whether they're sitting in Congress, it doesn't matter where they're sitting, they will not be immune from the, I'll just say, the power of the states and the parties to remove them. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is the supreme law of the land, and it will be enforced. We have to start getting very comfortable with holding our public servants accountable. You know what? You want to step into that realm of being a public servant. You have to accept the fact that you're going to be held accountable to that oath. So if you have no scruples and you're only going into Congress to, you know, make millions of dollars, then you might as well not go in anymore. Because we're closing the deal. We're shutting the doors on you. We're demanding full compliance. How dare you continue to think you're going to get away with this stuff? America is waking up and realizing the extent of the law, the truth of the law, and where the power really lies. Folks, you have to send that message. We cover this content on a regular basis to give you enough profound facts on the framing of this Constitution, on how it's defined. We give you all of the facts so that you can be a statesman in your county, so you can be a statesman in your state and lead the charge and actually step into the fray, be willing to be held accountable like Jerry Winstrand. I can't tell you enough. He needs love. We need to get Jerry Winstrand in that state house. Not state house, but actually as the auditor within the state executive branch, and start having him call out all of these constitutional violations, especially those things that fall within his will. Well, bottom line, folks, we can't. As a matter of fact, one of the things that, you know, we need to start asking questions is, why is it that our state legislatures aren't in an emergency session with the way things are right now?
Hallelujah on that.
I mean, I think that if the states, if a couple of states went into an emergency session, not to, so that they're trying to bilk the people, but the reality is we're in such a bad, dire strait that the next financial collapse will literally cause, you know, the change necessary for the globalists to just seize control. Folks, we have to demand all of our politicians to understand, recognize, and begin acting. We need to start interposing. We're losing time. It's not that this content has been going out. It's now we've got a great record on Reclaiming the Republic because we're giving you what we're covering, and then you can listen to it. So, you know, out of however many podcasts we have, and currently we're coming up on 2,000, but I'm not, you know, getting 1,000 out a year. It's probably just a couple hundred, maybe a couple hundred. It is all within reason for people to start downloading, listening to, and focusing on these resolutions, on other content. Work with me. I'll be happy to create mentoring meetings and help you get organized and help you get kicked off and started. So, and I'll already tell you, got to be honest, I'm already overtapped. There are more and more people. This is why it's critical that I spend the time, as much as I possibly and humanly can, in preparing you to basically lead on these things. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, you cannot run down this road of demanding full compliance and then not actually, you know, create that and not go down and actually say you're demanding it and not demand it. In other words, half step or try to, you know, take advantage of your opportunity as a statesman, what have you. Because you'll be outed. You'll be outed by me. You'll be outed by everybody in the, that is working on this path. And you'll be outed by your own people. If you're a person of character, if you want to actually go down in the annals of history as somebody that took the sacrifice, took it on the chin and said, I am going to do this because it needs to be done. And if not me, then who? If not now, then when? There you go. Okay, so we've been covering the Kentucky, now the Virginia resolutions. And welcome back, Tammy. And so Tammy is, actually, let me just say this. I think when we last parted ways.
I'm here.
Yeah, I know that. When we last parted ways, there was a thought or maybe two that you didn't get a chance to express. And so I want to do a go back. We were talking about the Kentucky resolutions. Is there something that you wanted to, you just didn't have the time to go into?
Not that I recall. We ended up talking about Harriet Hageman.
Yes, and what a great opportunity she has. What a great opportunity she has. As a matter of fact, I'd love to see her put the heat on the state legislature. I'd love to see her actually start pointing to the state to say, we need to be doing these things. Because whether she wants to run as the governor or what she wants to do, I just think she's in the sweet spot right now.
She would be the perfect one to do it. She really would be.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think it was Taylor Haynes. I'm sorry, I was thinking another person that was a part of the Republic Review team. But Taylor Haynes, who was running for governor, he was a perfect person to do that as governor as well. And as a matter of fact, so if Harriet wants to continue to work out of, you know, the House, then, you know, she should actually step in. And I hate to, you know, tell it's a good idea to create a team, but if there are people that are willing to sign pledges and, you know, say, hold me accountable to my oath that I am here to fully enforce and to ensure compliance with the Constitution, period. Everything I do is all about supporting and defending that Constitution first and my main priority. Of course, I'll, you know, do all of these other things I need to do, but the current crisis that we have dictates. And so the governor would then basically say, we do need the legislature in an emergency session, whether they, you know, do part-time commuting. I don't care what it is. You're on the hook. There's a problem with many legislators because, you know, oh, I'm only doing this part-time. I don't want to give up my job. I've actually heard this from legislators. You put me in an emergency session, I'm going to have to resign because I don't have that time. Go ahead.
Anyway. I'll say bye. If that's the way they feel, if you're not here for it, then, you know, this is not a part-time gig.
Right, there you go. So,
well, I also had a question about what you were talking about with the pledge.
Uh-huh.
If they're taking a swearing an oath as required by the Constitution,
yeah,
then what is the point of them doing a pledge as well? So if they've already sworn an oath, that should be enough.
So absolutely, that should be enough. But what we want to do is we want to help them understand that they're signing off on a process. So when you read the pledge, read that pledge and understand that they're signing off on a process that if a legitimate petition comes through, that it passes through a constitutional compliance committee that says, you did violate your oath based on this vote, based on this action, based on this, that you violated it. The only way you can expunge your record, first off, you have to step down immediately. And then second off, if you do step down, then you need to make an appeal to the sheriff of your county or the, you know, where you got elected, where you came from. You got to go to your county, and then the sheriff has to basically convene a common law grand jury to review the facts to determine whether you can be exonerated or not before they fill that seat. Once you step down, the clock starts, where the process begins in replacing a U.S. senator, a state legislature, a judge, what have you. There is a process. When somebody dies or, you know, retires, steps down, resigns, whatever. So those processes kick in. It usually takes a month or two. I would say probably in the average case, it's probably about 2 months before a person, you know, fills a seat. So in other words, that person has 2 months to get that. And so if you look at the pledge, that person actually goes to their sheriff and has the sheriff sign it. And so we have it on record that you've signed this, that you're going to comply with this pledge. It's a lot more than just saying, I'm going to do this. You're now are going to do these things that you've signed off on. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Yeah, I'd invite anybody to go to our candidate endorsement page. We have the pledge there. Download it and review it and see why we're putting so much stress on this, because it legally binds them to actually submit to a process, not just, you know, that they're legally bound by an oath. On top of the legally binding by an oath, you're now legally binding yourself to follow a specific process. Anyway, anything else we want to cover? And oh, by the way, maybe Tammy, we should probably, you know, talk offline as to how we can, you know, reach out and maybe, you know, good old Congresswoman Hageman into, you know, considering the opportunities that are presenting themselves. 2026 is when the presidential election kicks off. And I would love to see her. See, what happens is you don't even have to run a campaign for the presidency. All you have to do is run a campaign on the Constitution. And I will tell you that the people across this nation will say, that's what we need for president. All you have to do is not only be the demagogue to say this is all wrong, because that's what demagoguery is. Obama was a demagogue. Trump was a demagogue. Every president that we've had have been nothing but demagogues. Now, we've had a couple presidents that actually said, we need to do these things. This is what we need to do. Well, as long as those things are constitutional, if not, they're just as equally a tyrant and a demagogue. If Harriet Hageman actually, you know, uses the demagoguery and doesn't say, we need to violate the Constitution, I'm willing to do these things unconstitutionally, if she points to what has to happen constitutionally, then everybody will start recognizing, wow, like on the immigration, this whole immigration problem, that the states need to own this and literally lay it out how, you know, this is an ironclad process that does not allow people to run across our border. And that if the state decides to bring people in, you know, where they bring an ugly amount of people in to harm their state, then that can become a problem itself as well. But that's for the people of that state to decide. But I believe that now we're at a point where I think all things immigration are going to, you know, need to be literally scrutinized. I believe the majority of the states will make sure that the federal government, you know, keeps these rogue states in check to make sure that they're not bringing in an inordinate amount of people. But you got to remember that the onus is on the individual that immigrates. If they don't have the money to come, then they're not really qualified to be an immigrant. Does that make sense? The people that came to America had to pay the fare to get here. They had to actually pay the fare to get into the wagons, to go across the plains, to show up in Illinois, to show up in Denver, wherever they were going. They had to get there. And so it's not our responsibility to fly them in the middle of the night to throw them somewhere, nor is it, you know, the law doesn't allow them to just come across and say, you know, I want to stay here. No, you're an invader and you've got to go back. So anyway, Resolution 6. So Tammy, what we kind of covered already in the first couple of resolutions is Madison laying down the gauntlet and laying out interposition. And then when we go through resolution 4 and 5, he's kind of amplifying the audit process that Jefferson had applied. So in other words, he's adding to the argument of the Virginia resolutions that these things literally did, and we confirmed that they are violations to the Constitution and so forth. So I think he further does this and further supports this in the 6th resolution. So go ahead and pick that up from here.
Okay. I have that this state having by its convention, which ratified the federal constitution, expressly declared that among other essential rights, the liberty of conscience and of the press cannot be canceled, abridged, restrained, or modified by any authority of the United States. From its extreme anxiety to guard these rights from every possible attack of sophistry or ambition, having with other states recommended an amendment for that purpose, which amendment was in due time annexed to the Constitution, it would mark a reproachable inconsistency and criminal degeneracy if an indifference were now shown to the most palpable violation of the rights thus declared and secured, and to establish of a precedent which may be fatal to the other.
Okay, Sean, this sounded like the last one you read, but this isn't the same one, is it?
I think we did read that twice, but it's worth reading twice.
Okay. Well, let me double check real quick and find out the word degeneracy does, because you did say that. So, yeah, so we did read it twice. That's okay. You're right. It's always good to rephrase these. So, okay, so this was another part of the reinforcing Thomas Jefferson's audit. So, Sean, go ahead and pick up the 7th resolution. Go ahead.
Number 7. That the good people of this commonwealth, having ever felt and continuing to feel the most sincere affection for their brethren of the other states, the truest anxiety for establishing and perpetuating the union of all, and the most scrupulous, i.e. honorable, fidelity to that constitution, which is the pledge of mutual friendship and the instrument of mutual happiness, the General Assembly doth solemnly appeal to the like dispositions of the other states, in confidence that they will concur with this commonwealth in declaring, as it does hereby declare, that the acts aforesaid are unconstitutional, and that the necessary and proper measures will be taken by each for cooperating with this state in maintaining the authorities, rights, and liberties referred to the states respectively or to the people.
Okay, so first half of this is a reaffirmation of their mutual friendship and their commitment, you know, to maintaining this union and doing whatever necessary they need to do. But it actually goes into the comment here that follows the last half of this resolution, that they solemnly appeal to the other states, to their dispositions, to their feelings, their sentiments, in confidence. So they're making this appeal out to them in confidence that they will, or that these other states will concur with this commonwealth in declaring, as it does hereby declare, that the acts aforesaid are unconstitutional, and that the necessary and proper measures will be taken by each for cooperating with this state in maintaining the authority, rights, and liberties referred to the states respectively or to the people. Madison here is asserting clearly that the states invoke their authority over their compact. And at any point in time, folks, when you make a compact and all of a sudden, you know, you've got somebody that's, you know, executing, because your compact creates maybe a general contractor to support you, or some general business or general government to support you, like our Constitution does. At any point in time, that government, that entity, starts assuming any type of powers not delegated, and when you actually start challenging them, this is where Madison's going to get into this. We're getting very close because we're almost through this, where Madison actually starts pointing out that the states cannot, or not the states, that the federal courts cannot be that final arbiter. It's like Madison stated in one of the Federalist Papers an axiom that is very clear. No man should ever be judge of his own crime. Giving the federal court the ability to judge for the federal government whether they committed a crime or not violates that premise. If that be the case, if that be the precedence, then I believe that anybody that's charged with a crime should be afforded the ability to judge for themselves, as the court has now assumed. It's hypocrisy for the courts to be able to say, we're above the fray. Period. All men are corruptible and contemptible. All men. So, we have to hold everybody to these checks and balances. We have to really hold everybody to this concept of what I'll call more than just honor. We have to contain them by making sure that they are not able to get out of that box. In other words, we got to make sure that the ability for the federal court to actually get involved and start interpreting and changing and creating benefits for themselves, that's got to be recognized as what it is. It's an aggrandizement of power that's not granted, and it is an opportunist or an opportunist entity, agency, that is literally out growing and justifying for itself and its brethren, its sibling government departments or branches, saying, we can do whatever we want to you. That's all the federal courts have been doing. Very rarely, and when we look at the little token things such as the Chevron, the overturning of the Chevron the case and so forth, Roe v. Wade, those are just little tokens of, okay, we'll let you have this back. When in reality, they had never had jurisdiction over this. Folks, they never had jurisdiction over what we call the ability to create corporate persons, or even for the federal government to create corporations or even regulate corporations. So I digress. Let's get into Resolution 8. Tammy, this is yours. Go ahead.
That the governor be desired to transmit a copy of the foregoing resolutions to the executive authority of the other states with the request that the same may be communicated to the legislature thereof, and that a copy be furnished to each of the senators and representatives representing this state in the Congress of the United States.
And there we go. So we just finished up the Virginia resolutions. These are probably the most powerful because this is where we can literally see Madison stating the role of the parties. It is the party's responsibility, and what they need to do is they need to interpose. The problem was they didn't have the tools back then. I can understand why the Supreme Court wanted to create this delusionary wall that they've laid out, or you can't do that, because we now actually have a tool in the Constitution, in the 14th Amendment, to hold them accountable. Do you think that there's been a, and this is really an open question for both of you, we only have less than a minute, so we can cover this when we come back from the break, but the question is this: do you believe that the onslaught attacks over the legitimacy, the redefining of the 14th Amendment, the way the 14th Amendment has been attacked by both the federal government, by conservatives and liberals, do you believe we have been indoctrinated and programmed to turn our back on the 14th Amendment? Anyone want to start off on a rant on that? Go ahead.
I heard Ilhan Omar use it yesterday to justify that all the Somalis that are committing fraud and are illegal migrants are Americans because they were born in the country, even though the people they were born to were never...
Yes, so they weren't under the jurisdiction
of...
There you go, right there. So, as a matter of fact, that's a great point. We can bring that up when we come back, because the 14th Amendment has been completely perverted by obviating this under the jurisdiction thereof. And as a matter of fact, I deal with this with sovereign citizens. So we'll dive into that really quick when we come back. And any comments that Tammy is stewing on, because I know she's probably going to fire hose us. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so there are a lot of people that have kind of misconstrued this concept that any person living here and or born or naturalized has become a citizen of the United States. So, in other words, they're basically the sovereign citizen or the state nationals. They argue that the way this clause has been redefined by them and by courts and so forth is that you, because they've redefined this whole thing of a U.S. citizen, that you now become a subject to the state. When you read the definition of that clause in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, what it did was it identified all persons that were born or naturalized in the United States who were under the jurisdiction of the United States were now citizens. In other words, it didn't take people that were inhabitants but went under the jurisdiction. How were they under the jurisdiction of the United States? There was only two classes of people at that point in time that clause actually pointed out and dealt with. Only two. Any guesses of who those two groups or classes of people were? Anybody?
Citizens and slaves?
No. So slaves were born and or not naturalized, because the whole point was to actually naturalize them or make them citizens. So those people who were born and or they say naturalized under the jurisdiction of the United States. So is a U.S. citizen, if he's living within the state of Kentucky, is he under the jurisdiction of the United States as a U.S. citizen?
Yes.
Okay, so he's already a citizen. So are they declaring him a citizen? No. No, all they're doing is they're basically creating the other caveat that those people who are under the jurisdiction that have not naturalized but have been born here, not under the jurisdiction of another state. So you have to look at a person being born. When a child is born, their jurisdiction is tied to their parents. So if those parents have lived in the United States for years and years, and their parents lived in the United States for years and years, you know, going back, you know, to the importation of persons, what have you, then those persons, then because they've never been under the jurisdiction of a foreign nation, they were brought here as property and under the jurisdiction of the United States as a slave. How is a slave under the jurisdiction of the United States?
Because they were considered property.
Well, actually, they were considered both property and person, because they were given an apportionment in the Constitution as 3/4 to every slave, or 3/5. So in other words, every slave had a portional apportionment for representation.
But would you say that they were given that, or the state was given that on their behalf?
So the state received representation on their behalf, of just like a regular citizen. So in other words, when you have that, see, the state What the state wanted to do was they wanted to basically make all things equal, that they were both property as well as persons. They said, well, you can't do that. It can't be both. And then they said, well, okay, so it's going to be fractional, because they wanted the this was a part of the compromise. They wanted to be able to say, well, they're a little bit of both. They're property, you know, where their slave owner controls them, but they should still be entitled to representation, a portion of representation. Now, you got to remember that even though they were never able to vote, a person, a full citizen, and oh, by the way, most of the states by that point in time had these laws of mulattoes, that if you were half and half, that when you reached a certain age, like 30, 31, somewhere in there, that the mulatto would then become, would be set free, because they served their half, you know, life as a slave. They, that was recognized that they were half slave. Now they could live the other half of their life as a free person. Virginia had that law in effect.
Wow.
Were you aware of this?
No, it was not. That just flabbergasted me. That's just amazing.
Okay, so here's the interesting thing. Thomas Jefferson in 1770 represented a mulatto who was petitioning for their freedom because their slave owner wouldn't grant it to them because it was the law. So Thomas Jefferson argued in court that we were all created equal. That's where that phrase came from, was from that particular law case. That we were all created equal. So he argued this in court, that technically we were all created equal. But the law of Virginia basically recognized that if you were born mulatto, half and half, that your first half of your life you would be slave and would be set free. And he goes, this person has this right by the law to be set free. So anyway, so it wasn't, I don't think Virginia was an outlier. I think that many of the states probably had that. Probably the further south you go, the more constraints or less open they were to those types of things. But again, Virginia at that point in time in 1770 and moving forward, they were becoming more and more lenient towards the slaves until things started going radical in the 1800s, where the northern states and the abolition movement really started threatening them. So it forced states to become, you know, take more of a bad position or be worse in this. But anyway, the point is that the jurisdiction thereof applied to Indians as well, because Indians were basically prisoners on a federal reservation within a state. In other words, they were literally under the jurisdiction of the United States. The United States told them what they could do. The United States unconstitutionally assumed the control of them and unconstitutionally consumed and dictated what and how they could function and so forth. So the point is that when you really look at our Indians who were born here and born here and born here but never naturalized, did that clause, Article 1, or I should say Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, does that not apply to them as well? Persons born here, and naturalized, or persons born here and are naturalized under the jurisdiction of the United States are now citizens. That actually applied to them. They became citizens under that. Anyway, Tammy, did you have anything that you wanted to add to the Virginia resolutions and all that?
No, but I think this, the born and naturalized, you know, born or naturalized and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So I think we just need to keep reiterating over and over. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could be born here, but if their parents aren't citizens, then they're not subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
That's right. Yep.
They're subject to the jurisdiction of their parents.
Right. Okay. So, Tammy, I think this one's yours, right? Or did you read the last one? I'm sorry. We need to read Resolution 8. Resolution 8.
Okay. Are we on 8?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, what?
I thought we finished. Did we not finish?
No, we still have 8
to do. We still have 8 to do.
Okay. That the governor be desired to transmit a copy of the foregoing resolutions. Well, we did read this.
We did?
I'll keep going.
No. So if we did, then both Sean and I, because you read it before, and that's why we have you on here, is to keep us, you know, honest. We don't want to, you know, assume or punish anybody by reading the same things over and over again. So that means that we're done with the Virginia resolutions, which means what is the next document that is in the queue for us to go through? Well, that next document is the Kentucky resolutions of 1799. Now, again, Jefferson writes this one. And actually, the state received a bunch of feedback from other states that literally insulted the state legislature and actually insinuated that they were being treasonous and that, you know, it wasn't good. And as a matter of fact, this is what, you know, we'll dive into how it affected Thomas Jefferson. And so let's just dive into, since Tammy, since you did read 8 before, then I guess it is Sean's turn to kick this off in the Kentucky Resolutions of 99 with Resolution number 1. Go ahead, Sean.
The representatives of the good people of this Commonwealth in General Assembly convened have maturely considered the answers of sundry states in the Union to their resolutions passed at the last session. Respecting certain unconstitutional laws of Congress, commonly called the Alien and Sedition Laws, would be faithless indeed to themselves and to those they represent were they silently to acquiesce in principles and doctrines attempted to be maintained in all those answers, that of Virginia only excepted. To again enter the field of argument and attempt more fully or forcibly to expose the unconstitutionality of those obnoxious laws would, it is apprehended, be as unnecessary as unavailing.
Okay, so here he's basically pointing out that now they, having maturely considered the answers, okay, now they got the responses from the other states. The only state, he's pointing out, that actually had, you know, a positive answer was Virginia. And so now he's going, well, hold on here. Are we not going to hold them accountable to these, he calls them here, obnoxious laws? Let's go ahead into the second resolution, because he kind of sets the tone of where they are moving forward. Go ahead.
We cannot, however, but lament that in the discussion of those interesting subjects, by sundry of the legislatures of our sister states, unfounded suggestions and uncandid insinuations derogatory of the true character and principles of the good people of this Commonwealth have been substituted in place of fair reasoning and sound argument. Our opinions of those alarming measures of the general government, together with our reasons for those opinions, were detailed with decency and with temper and submitted to the discussion and judgment of our fellow citizens throughout the Union. Whether the decency and temper have been observed in the answers of most of those states who have denied or attempted to obviate the great truths contained in those resolutions, we have now only to submit to a candid world. Faithful to the true principles of the Federal Union, unconscious of any designs to disturb the harmony of that Union, and anxious only to escape the fangs of despotism, the good people of this Commonwealth are, regardless of censure or culmination.
Yeah, it's culmination. And so, yes.
Culmination.
So, okay. So here Thomas Jefferson opens up with the fact that we can only lament. And he basically moves on and says, as our sister states made unfounded suggestions and uncandid insinuations, derogatory to the true character and principles of the good people of this Commonwealth. You could tell he was taking a very defensive position, because they were literally saying and attacking and insinuating such derogatory comments. It was just like, wow. You know, and actually, as I've read this a few times, a good friend and, you know, I'll just say a patriot that I have the privilege of working with, Woody, We were talking, and so he actually went out and did the due diligence and looking and pulled in, I believe it was the Kentucky responses, the states from Kentucky. I honestly think, now that I'm thinking about it, it may have been on the Virginia website, but either way, he pulled in one of the states. And when we looked at it, there were some assertions, because I remember if it was, I think it was Massachusetts. Well, Massachusetts was clearly saying, no, 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 the federal government is the final arbiter on all things. Or I should say not the federal government, the Supreme Court, which is contrary to how they went through their ratification debates. And I'm going, wow, did the people of Massachusetts realize and understand what these federalists in the state of Massachusetts were saying and doing? So, okay, so he lays this out to say, hey, you know, being faithful to these principles of the federal union, you know, we actually have to do something regardless. And it's, you know, censure or calumniation. So let's go on to this third one. And so we can jump into the final resolved. So go ahead, Sean.
Least, however, the silence of this Commonwealth should be construed into an acquiescence in the doctrines and principles advanced and attempted to be maintained by the said answers, or at least those of our fellow citizens throughout the Union, who so widely differ from us on those important subjects, should be deluded by the expectation that we shall be deterred from what we conceive our duty, or shrink from the principles contained in those resolutions. Therefore,
okay, so he lays it out. He basically says, you know what? We don't care what you say. We have a responsibility, and we're not going to allow you to basically deride us. We're not going to allow you to deter us. We're not going to allow you to dilute what we're trying to do and to marginalize or minimize what we're trying to do. Therefore, then they come into this fourth resolution. Now, this fourth resolution, as a matter of fact, if you notice, that it starts off with paragraph one, paragraph two, paragraph three, and then resolved. Because this became the final disposition of Kentucky regarding this entire matter, I stated this before, this is why the academic world considered this to be the actual resolution, and the resolutions before were drafts. I say not. The initial resolutions were communications seeking engagements of the other states. What the academics have done is literally tried to get you to look at that document. Oh, that's just draft. It didn't go out. Well, they didn't change the context of the fact that it did go out. But by labeling it that draft, it would be easy for a person to dismiss it, to say, well, that's just a draft. Let me actually read the resolutions of Kentucky. And then they would just jump to this without going into all the minutiae and details of how egregious the Alien and Sedition Acts really were. Okay, so, Tammy, let's dive into this resolution. Now, this is a long one, so I definitely want to dissect some parts of this as we go along. Go ahead.
Okay. Resolved that this Commonwealth considers the Federal Union upon the terms and for the purposes specified in the late compact as conducive to the liberty and happiness of the several states, that it does now unequivocally declare its attachment to the Union and to that compact, agreeable to its obvious and real intention, and will be among the last to seek its dissolution.
Okay, so right there, he basically says, we're not leaving the Union. Why is he saying that? Because he's calling for nullification. Technically, and as a matter of fact, but he never divulged this, never got into the nuts and bolts of this, but apparently it was kind of common knowledge. And we didn't really get into, you know, this principle that you cannot nullify a federal law and remain in the Union. Later on, because as things went on and, you know, things progressed over slavery and so forth, a character from, I think, South Carolina called John C. Calhoun started redefining the resolutions of Kentucky and Virginia, because at that point in time, the concept of nullification was not really well taught, and it was not really well understood. It wasn't common knowledge as well. So he started redefining it, which caused Madison to jump in with an 18-page document on notes on nullification, clearly stating several times, I think he goes through the argument in these 18 pages like four or five times. And in each time he goes through it, he takes a different angle. But the point is that he consistently says you cannot, a state cannot singly nullify a law and remain in the union. So if it was simply nullifying the law, if Kentucky was literally just saying, we don't agree, we're not going to enforce that law does not exist in this state, if they're going to take that position, they would have to leave the state. So here is this, right here, there's this little veiled comment that talks about, we're not here to seek dissolution in leaving the union. Okay, so it's a nuance that most people, as a matter of fact, as I read through Thomas Wood's book, you know, Thomas Wood's book was a real inspiration for me. Then as I started reading this more and more, I realized there's many great things that he completely missed. Sometimes it takes, you know, it takes the time to read things over and over and over and over again to start really realizing the depth of what is being covered by these great minds. So bottom line, Thomas Jefferson basically laid it out, we're not seeking a dissolution. So keep in mind, we're here for, you know, at least for now, to suffer with you. Go ahead, keep going.
So GR, are you saying that even if something is unconstitutional, the states can't nullify it alone, or they have to leave the union?
Well, so I am saying at this juncture, when we get into Madison's notes regarding state nullification, there are conditions that a state can actually nullify the law and stay in the union. But we have to go into that to differentiate between something like this, okay, and something that, you know, that really requires true nullification, because Madison differentiates the impact upon the state of that law. Anyway, so when we get into the notes, that'll help everything. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. That if those who administer the general government be permitted to transgress the limits fixed by that compact, by a total disregard to the special delegations of power therein contained, annihilation of the state governments, and the erection upon their rules of a general consolidated government will be the inevitable consequence. That the principle and construction contended for by sundry of the state legislatures, that the general government is the exclusive judge of the extent of the powers delegated to it, stop nothing short of despotism, since the discretion of those who administer the government and not the Constitution would be the measure of their powers.
Okay,
that
so right. So no, I'm sorry.
Formed that instrument.
I'm sorry. So the measure of their power. So clearly, Thomas Jefferson now has gone to this space to say, "Wow, you know, if we continue to let this happen, then they're going to continue to make it up as they go along." Sean, remember that reference regarding interposition?
Right.
Right. I mean that. So, over time, the courts have basically argued and tried to, you know, it's like they've completely converted their role in this union to being the actual, you know, the only party to the compact, that we become subjects to the compact, as if the Constitution was created and as all people and all land came unto it, it owned it. Or I should say, the federal government owned that land. It owned that people as it started arriving. And that's not the case. As we went through this in the Kentucky resolutions, that the states created that compact. And therefore, the federal government, being a creature created by the compact itself, making the states their parents. And they have, and he's basically saying that it would be the measure of their powers. In other words, they're going to go down this path to where it's their discretion. They're going to choose for themselves what powers they want to execute to that degree. Okay, so...
like prophecy.
Yes, and that's where it's, that's where they're at today, folks. So go ahead, Tammy. Keep going.
Okay. Kind of lost my spot. Where were we?
That the several states who formed that instrument.
Yes.
Okay. That the several states who formed the instrument, being sovereign and independent, have the unquestionable right to judge of its infraction and that a nullification by those sovereignties of all unauthorized acts done under color of that instrument is the rightful remedy.
Okay, so
at this commonwealth,
at that point, Thomas Jefferson is basically saying that they have, as a rightful remedy, to basically leave the Union, say, this violates the Constitution, it is both willful and material, and we're done. That if the states can't come together to basically force this, it is their rightful remedy to leave the Union. Now, there's another way of nullifying without leaving the Union. We'll get into that in Madison's notes on 1834. You know, I wish somebody would have actually wrote the details on this, but when you actually go through these writings, somebody could actually start creating like a Blackstone's commentaries on the Constitution, our laws, and so forth, because I think that's what needs to happen. Anyway, okay, keep going.
That this commonwealth does upon the most deliberate reconsideration declare that the said alien and sedition laws are, in their opinion, palpable violations of the said Constitution, and however cheerfully it may be disposed to surrender its opinion to a majority of its sister states in matters of ordinary or doubtful policy, yet in momentous regulations like the present, which so vitally wound the best rights of the citizen, it would consider a silent acquiescence as highly criminal.
Yes, there you go. And so he continues on. I don't think I can add much. I mean, he's just ranting at this point, but keep going.
Okay. That although this commonwealth, as a party to the federal compact, will bow to the laws of the Union, yet it does at the same time declare that it will not now nor ever hereafter cease to oppose in a constitutional manner every attempt from what quarter soever offered to violate that compact.
Okay, so we're literally running out of time. So at this point, I will because I don't have the time to really go into a diatribe regarding what he basically said in these last two, you know, the red underlined and the highlighted underlined. So I'll cover that in our next meeting, our next recording, the next show. So folks, as it's clear, Thomas Jefferson has kind of laid out this big paradigm. But again, there's something behind the curtain that needs to be clarified, because in these instances, the rule and measure of these laws didn't really require or drive them to nullify. So I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. We'll cover this more later.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.